Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri, inviting you to discover what research, projects and events are taking place at the University of Malta. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today for University Matters on Campus FM, Dr. Joseph A. Borge. Dr. Borge is a senior lecturer and head of Department of Biology here at the University of Malta. Just a few words, as usual, about my guest. He obtained BSc and MSc degrees from this university and his PhD from the University of Plymouth in the UK. His teaching interests are in the areas of animal biology, ecology, and marine biology. His research activities are mainly focused on ecological assessment and monitoring, with particular emphasis on themes concerning marine ecology. He's involved in research on the ecology of seagrass and algal habitats and on the environmental impacts of aquaculture. Dr. Borge has been carrying out marine environmental surveys since 1991, using scientific diving and other in-situ survey techniques, as well as remote sensing procedures. In 2006, he chaired the local organizing committee of the Mediterranean Seagrass Workshop, which was hosted by the Department of Biology. He is currently committee member of the Mediterranean Seagrass Association, Seagrass 2000, a non-profit association that promotes Mediterranean seagrass research, and a member of several international working groups dealing with interactions between aquaculture and the environment and the development of sustainable mariculture. Dr. Borge is visiting fellow at the Marine Institute of the University of Plymouth and adjunct associate professor of integrated science and technology at the James Madison University in the USA. He publishes regularly and acts as reviewer for several leading international marine biology journals. Currently, he is review editor for the Journal of Aquaculture Environment Interactions. Welcome to the program, Dr. Borge.
Thank you, Patricia. Thanks for the invitation.
This is going to be another in the series of cost action interviews that I've been doing over the last weeks. It is a fascinating experience discussing these very varied scientific topics. This particular one is called Seagrass Productivity from Genes to Ecosystem Management. So that is what we're going to be discussing today. Perhaps we can start off with a description of what seagrasses really are. We might be vaguely familiar with them here around our coasts, people who swim around Malta, but perhaps you can tell us really what they're all about.
Okay, so seagrasses are flowering plants. They are, as the name implies, seagrass marine grasses. They're flowering plants. They actually therefore produce seeds and the flower. There are about 60 species worldwide. In the Mediterranean, we have 5. Locally, we have 3, of which the most abundant and most, known is Posidonia oceanica, lepching grass, in Maltese, alca. The common name, alca, is a bit of a misnomer because the seagrass is not an alga. It's very different from algae. Algae are not flowering plants. Okay, there are many more species. In Maltese, the proper term of algae is Has talbahar. Okay, so alca, it may
it's
be a misguiding.
Just what the general public
exactly.
calls it.
Yeah, that's what you call it. So apart from lepching grass from Posidonia, we also have one called Cymodosia nodosa, which is the lesser lepching grass. And the third seagrass we have in Malta is actually an immigrant, an alien species, Halophila stipulacea, which we think came in from the Red Sea. The Posidonia oceanica, not the Cymodosia, Posidonia, is actually endemic to the Mediterranean, so we find it exclusively in the Mediterranean. Here in Malta, it's the most abundant seagrass. It's also the largest of the 3. So it's a big plant. It has leaves that can be a meter long and about 1 centimeter wide. And at a depth of, shallow depths of around 1 meter, just 1 meter, you can have up to 1,000 plants per square meter. So the density is very high. the extension, the bathymetric, that is depth extension of this Posidonia oceanica, is between, say, 1 meter and 43, 45 meters water depth. Same Odosia is found, apart from the Mediterranean, it's found in the Atlantic as well and other places. And Halophila is typically a Red Sea species. So these sea grasses, in particular Posidonia, what they do is you mostly find them on soft seabeds, that is sandy seabeds.
But they root into the sand.
That is one important difference from the algae. Sea grasses have roots, just like terrestrial plants do, and they are actually nearly the only plants that can colonize these sandy seabeds. Algae are not suited for that because they don't have true roots. So algae usually attach to hard seabeds like rock and other hard substrata, whereas the seagrasses attach to soft seabeds. They are extremely important for the marine ecosystem. They serve as habitats for numerous species, fish and invertebrates, some of which are of commercial importance, of high commercial importance. They protect the coast against erosion because their leaves act as a buffer. They slow down wave action and water movement. Obviously, being plants, they provide lots of oxygen to the water, so they are oxygenators.
In fact, normally we sort of see them as brown.
That's right.
Seagrass on the
yes.
Washed up on the beach.
Yes.
But in actual
yes.
fact, if you were to look
at a mask.
With a mask underneath the water, you'd see
yes.
they're green.
Yes, it's like looking at a field of grass. What happens is that, again, like some terrestrial plants in around autumn, when you get the first storms, they release their old leaves that would already have started turning brown. When they are detached, they then turn completely brown, and they're washed ashore, forming, the technical term is banquettes. They form these banks of dead leaves, which incidentally also protect the beaches against sand erosion, against erosion. So even the dead leaves have a very important function. The living plants, which form what we call meadows or beds, and they are important because, like we're saying, they support many other species. It's very easy to record, for example, 300 species from a single bay associated with the seagrass. They use the habitat to lay their eggs, to feed, they find food, and also very important as a refuge against predators. Species hide in the seagrass.
Going back to the brown ones that we see on the beach, then probably it isn't a very good idea then to keep clearing them off. Probably a better idea to leave them there during winter.
Definitely.
To protect the beach.
Definitely. In fact, one mistake we used to do many years back, actually decades ago, because now it's not done anymore, is that we used to remove these banquettes even during winter when we need them most. Storms are prevalent during autumn and winter. If we remove these banquettes, we expose the underlying sand to more erosion. So, previously it was a mistake to remove them. It's best to leave them at least in winter. In summer, people don't like it. You know, they prefer staying on the clean sand and so on, so they remove it. But at least in winter, and ideally also in autumn, they be left over there.
We said that they put their roots down in sand, but where would we find them around Malta? Where do you find them mostly, even on the east side of Malta? Mostly it's the sort of rocky beaches.
That's an interesting question. Actually, yes, if you look at the shore, okay, in Malta, we only have a small percentage of sandy beaches. I think the total value is around 2% of our shores are sand or soft sediment, we call them cobbles or whatever. But if you look underwater, wherever you go in Malta, even below rocky shores and below cliffs, at a certain point you will start finding sand. So although we do not see it, most of the seabed around the Maltese islands are sandy. Okay, including where there is Rocconi, you don't see any sand in terms of beaches and so on. However, since I mentioned that these seagrasses, for example, Posidonia, is only found up to a maximum of 45 meters, and that's related to light availability, because once you go deeper than 45 meters, there isn't enough light for them. If you are within that depth range, you will find seagrass, especially Posidonia, around most of the Maltese islands. An exception are the southwestern coasts, where you have the Dingle Cliffs area, Tachanch, and so on. Because over there, you practically have depths greater than 45 meters right below the cliff. So you will not find seagrasses over there. But especially off the northeastern coast, of the Maltese Islands. That is, I would say, starting from around Bayar in Gozo, or a bit further from there, maybe Guitelasri, all the way down to Marsa Shlok and Benaisa. We have extensive, very extensive meadows of seagrasses.
We've spoken about how important they are to the ecosystem because they protect other species and they use as also a home for others. What other things do they do? I mean, why should we, do we know if they have medicinal qualities? Of what other use are they to us as humans?
Okay, the goods and services, let's use that recently popular terminology, the goods and services they provide, are mostly indirect rather than direct. Okay, so there are traditional uses of seagrasses around the world, and including in the Mediterranean. For example, before we had these synthetic material to fill pillows, okay, you know that they used to use feathers before. Mm-hmm. So people who were allergic to feathers used to fill their pillows with this seagrass, the brown dead leaves. It also used to be used to make hats, okay, out of the leaves, sometimes in the Mediterranean, but also especially in outside the Mediterranean, especially the North American coasts, the indigenous Indians over there, who also used it for clothes. Going back locally, some farmers use it to store potatoes. Okay, they make a bed of the seagrass, the dead leaves, and they store potatoes on it. At one point, in some buildings, it has been used as an insulator. Those are some of the traditional uses. The indirect goods and services are more important. That is, like we mentioned, for example, reducing coastal erosion, protecting the coast, providing oxygen, providing a habitat for many species, including commercial ones. So most of the goods and services are indirect.
What about as a biological marker? One presumes that that's one of the things which you're obviously looking into very much. They show us what's going wrong.
Yes, they do. In fact, seagrass, especially in the Mediterranean, are one of the bioindicators, we call them. That are used. There are four bioindicators for the Water Framework Directive, which has been it's a new directive, a very important one that has been also implemented in Malta. And seagrasses are one of the four indicators. The four indicators are seagrasses, algae, plankton, phytoplankton, and macroalgae and algae. Okay, so seagrasses are one of them. What we do is we take samples of the plant. And we measure things like the length of the leaves, the number of leaves per shoot, per plant. And these indicate the state of the plant and also the state of the environment. So, in a place where there is some pollution, you will start getting shorter leaves, for example, perhaps a smaller number of leaves per plant. Certain indicators also you get in slightly polluted waters or nutrient-enriched waters, like where there is sewage. You start getting things growing on the leaves, like other plants and other animals. And what these do is that they reduce the amount of light available to the plant. So the plant, it's detrimental to it, and it reduces its growth rate. So it grows less, you know, the rate of growth is less, and so on. So, yes, they use as markers. In extreme cases of pollution, the seagrass disappears. So you just don't find it. You will know that it was there because you will find the roots and the rhizomes sometimes buried in the sediment. For example, if you were to take a course over here in the Grand Harbor, Pietà, Msida, if you were to take a core of the sediment, go down, for example, 7 meters, you will bring up these roots, remains of Posidonia, which indicates that once we had even seagrass in these parts. So they are good indicators, yes.
With me in the University Matters studio at Campus FM today is Dr. Joseph A. Borge, and we're discussing a cost action project concerning seagrass. Let's talk about the pressures that these seagrasses have, because there must be many different kinds of pressure, human and not human.
Yes, unfortunately, there are many pressures. Anything that changes the quality of the water is one of them, and there are many. For example, if there is pollution, for example, by toxic substances, okay, that will have detrimental effects on the seagrasses. but also if the turbidity of the water increases, that is, the clarity decreases. In that case, the plant doesn't get enough light, so it's a question of light availability, and either it reduces its growth rate, or it stops growing completely, or it starts dying off. So water quality is crucial. Then there are some physical adverse impacts. For example, anchoring is one adverse impact. When a boat lowers its anchors on its anchor on Posidonia, the anchor obviously goes down into the meadow, and when the boat starts pulling because the wind pushes the boat and so on, the anchor starts literally plowing into the meadow and starts ripping off the plants. Okay, so that's physical. Then other physical ones are, for example, when you have dredging, okay, and the release of particulate matter in the water, that settles on the leaves, on the plants, it reduces the amount of light again, and the plant is affected adversely. And also, for example, burial. I mean, obviously, if one makes a construction in the sea, okay, it can be, for example, an extended jetty going out for quite a distance in the sea, that obviously replaces, decimates the seagrass completely. So there are quite a few adverse impacts.
Those are the human ones. What about something like global climate change, or maybe affected by that?
Actually, recent research has shown that since climate change may lead to more carbon dioxide in the seas, they have found that seagrasses may actually benefit from this. So that is one plus side. We're not exactly sure of this, because one other effect of carbon dioxide in the water, in the marine environment, is the increase in acidity. So we're not sure how that will affect seagrasses, but scientists think that that is not very worrying. More worrying are temperatures. Okay, that's temperature increase.
Might happen locally.
Yes, how they will handle an increase in temperature. Keeping in mind also that when you increase the temperature of the water, you're reducing the amount of oxygen, okay, dissolved oxygen. And plants, although they do use carbon dioxide, they also need oxygen to produce carbon dioxide, because you have photosynthesis, which uses carbon dioxide, and respiration, you know, which produces carbon dioxide. So you have both processes. So, but overall, they think that perhaps if there wouldn't be large increases in temperature, the detrimental effects will not be that significant. And also, obviously, if there are differences in sea level, okay, if these are, again, drastic, okay, you can get areas that are affected. For example, a seagrass meadow that is currently at a depth of 1 meter, if this ends up in a shallower depth, increased depth, okay, it will not be able to have as many plants per square meter as previously. Okay, the greater the depth, okay, the less the seagrass is going to survive better. So even at the what we call the deep limit, the lower limit of the meadow, the deeper part, if at present it's at 35 meters, okay, or at its limit of 43 meters, if the sea level increases by 1 meter, then it's out of there, you know, it will start regressing.
Before going a little bit into what you're actually doing in the action itself, seagrass is protected by law in Malta, is it not?
Yes.
How does that work out? Has it helped?
It has. Yes, seagrass habitats are protected, especially Posidonia Oceanica is protected by EU legislation. The legislation has been transposed locally, so it applies locally as well. And in fact, these protected species, like Posidonia, are used as a basis to declare protected habitat areas. Okay, for example, because of the presence of Posidonia here in Malta, in the particular area between Imjar Harbour in Gozo, all the way down, including Comino, to Spinola, St. Julian's, all that area where there is seagrass is protected on the basis of the presence of Posidonia. And the local planning authority, the MEPA, chose and proposed that area, and now it's established as an SAC, a special area of conservation, the basis for this was that we have the most extensive meadows in that area, specifically. Okay, so Posidonia oceanica is most abundant in this area between, say, Camino Gozo Channel, the Malta Camino Channel, and all the way down, including the Sicca Albaida, all the way down to St. Julian's.
What about the fact that, through your directives, Malta has had to improve its sewage system, and now it seems as though almost all, if not all, of our sewage is being treated on land and not shoved into the sea? Has that already made a difference to the Posidonia meadows, or not yet?
Okay, up to now, the difference isn't that evident, because one thing about Posidonia in particular is that it's a very slow grower. It grows very slowly, and for example, over a period of 1 year, you don't get new plants. Okay, you get very few new plants produced. The differences are in the actual plant, you know, number of leaves and so on, because it's dropping its leaves, it's growing new ones and so on. That's where the dynamic change is. In terms of number of plants, the process is very, very slow. It takes a number of years for new plants to grow and so on, establish. So we haven't yet managed to detect the difference. But mentioning sewage, you know, you may know that the biggest sewage outfall we had was at Witamir, near Shira. Okay? Because of that sewage outfall, all the Posidonia between, say, Rinella, okay, all the way down to near Lison or Point, okay, had been decimated, so you don't find Posidonia in the area where there was this Witamir. We are predicting now that Posidonia will come back and will start growing in these areas. So we are eager to monitor, you know, this phenomenon, potential comeback.
Perhaps I'm going to say something stupid, but can you plant it?
Yes, you can. Actually, it's an area of research of seagrasses. Transplantation experiments. There have been mixed results. Some have been successful, others haven't. Interestingly, the most successful ones happened automatically, sort of naturally. The plant has established itself. So we've had cases where people have dumped, for example, rubble, okay, and this rubble got colonized by Posidonia.
Happening in strange ways.
But there have been transplantation experiments that have been worked as well, specifically. Mm-hmm.
Let's go into the actual action itself, because there are several aims that are mentioned in the blurb about it. Perhaps you can tell us exactly what they mean. Some of them are a little bit complicated. Trying to establish continuous in-situ measurement devices for seagrass productivity. What instruments are you using for that?
Basically, if you want to measure productivity is the amount of plant tissue, plant mass produced per unit time, per unit area. Okay? If you want to measure, so basically it's how much seagrass is being produced, new seagrass, new material. If you want to measure that, one way to do it is to measure how much oxygen is produced, because in the process of photosynthesis, carbon dioxide and water are used to produce oxygen and sugars. So during this process, you can measure the amount of oxygen produced, and it's not easy to do it in a laboratory. You can do it in a lab by taking some plants, putting them in an aquarium and measuring the amount of oxygen produced. But ideally, the best way to identify this and measure it and measure productivity using oxygen is by lowering a meter in the meadow that measures oxygen production, okay? And also measuring the amount of light available, and through this you work out how much photosynthesis basically is going on, and therefore how much material is produced.
Are these instruments that actually remain in the water, or do you go with the boat and do it and then take the instrument home with you?
There are both. Photosynthesis, typically, to measure it well, it's better to have a continuous reading. So continuous readings are always better, so there you need in-situ equipment. Doing it every now and then also works, but it's less good, as you know, compared to in-situ instruments.
What about the modelling and monitoring tool based on seagrass light requirements? That's another aspect of the picture.
Again, the scientists do is that they measure the amount of light availability and therefore productivity of seagrass in different conditions of water clarity. So you can have, for example, the same place like the Maltese Islands. You have varying degrees of water transparency. You know, for example, in Cominos, it's very transparent, very, very clean waters. And the northeastern coast of Gozo, places like Ramla, very clean and transparent waters, compared to areas where you have anthropogenic influence, some anthropogenic influence, for example, places like St. Paul's Bay, and perhaps Melia Bay, and also places like St. Julian's, okay? Situations where you have lots of pollution, for example, the harbors. The case in point is Maastricht Harbor, locally, where you have dredging being carried out all the time. You have many different influences over there, and the waters are quite turbid, and there is Posidonia still over there. So one would compare these and see how this is affecting the seagrass.
In the last minute that we have, what do you feel you've personally have got out of this networking opportunity, what you and your students perhaps have got out of it?
Well, I think we got a lot of very useful knowledge and information, because researchers and scientists do research, but sometimes they're isolated, okay? You know what they would have done when their paper is out, their article is out, and you see the results. But even then, they refer to certain techniques and certain instruments they would have used. Some of them would be new, and you're not sure, you know, what's the benefits and so on, because a scientific article doesn't go into the much detail of the methodology and so on. So interacting with these scientists who are doing cutting-edge research on seagrasses, interacting with them, sharing knowledge, and being able to visit their lab, especially COST provides the opportunity for these training visits for researchers. So you get, I'm able to send students, for example, postgrad students, and to these places where they have state-of-the-art equipment and multiple resources, so it is especially useful for us. And they learn, you know, of these techniques, of the instruments they use, how to use them in the field, the problems with them, you know, and that. But also, when we meet, we're obviously sharing data, we're sharing knowledge, ideas, and cost in this regard excels.
Well, thank you very, very much, Dr. Joseph Borge.
Thank you.
For coming on University Matters today to talk about this cost action regarding seagrasses. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to University Matters on Campus FM. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.